Oh, hello.
Hello.
Hello. We're in the exciting van. Would you introduce yourselves, please?
Andy Cluckwas.
Josh Norton.
Jamie Douglas.
They're the band, by the way, just so you know, because this is radio. To set the tone for the interview, I had the pleasure of listening to The Socialite in its entirety this week. And the number one thing that immediately resonated with me is, you know, there's rock and roll that takes itself seriously. There's rock and roll that's played really well. And then there's rock and roll that I like, which has got a sense of humor to it.
Yeah.
So, you know, you're making kind of a lot of statements in that record. And the things that work really, really well for me is when the music's happy and the music's, you know, pop, but it rocks. But also the lyrics kind of, you have to listen because there's stuff in there.
The sense of humor of rock and roll and the sense of sort of fun, even when you're trying to do something magnificent, has sort of been lost in a sort of way, hasn't it? Like, I like certain songwriters like Stephen Merritt and people like that from Magnetic Fields, who, even though it could be the most poignant sort of situation they're talking about, it still has a sense of humor to it. I mean, I'm Australian. We have you need a sense of humor to sort of get through it. You know what I mean? And I mean, isn't rock and roll meant to be fun in some sort of way? I mean, when the Beatles have a sense of humor in their music, nobody says that, oh, that's a funny song. You know what I mean? They say, that's Rocky Raccoon.
What is it like a night like tonight? You're about to play a record to an audience that hasn't heard it.
The thing for me is that I'm one of these performers who really feeds on what is actually going on in the now. So for me to be very stuck in my present, having to play something that's been mapped out for me before I go on stage, is sort of difficult, because I don't like that so much. You know, I don't like having to do the right thing all of the time on stage and make it true to it. But I did it recently in Los Angeles, and we did a midnight slot, you know, which we don't usually do, and we got to play the whole thing, and I had a lot of friends come up and help out with it and that sort of thing, and I actually liked it a lot more than most of the shows I've done over the last year, you know what I mean? So for me, I really enjoy it. But, you know, also having to have that text there all the time is because I think live and albums are just totally two different things, you know what I mean? Right. And you come up in this game with a lot of people telling you that you know, you've got to, oh, your live show's great, you've got to get your album sounding like your live show. Oh, your album's great, you've got to get your album sounding like your live show. I mean,
all right, I'm going to dig into a little revisionist history. You get to fill in, this is like Mad Libs, you get to fill in the end of this sentence. You were sent to boarding school because...
I don't know what you're talking about.
I think you do.
How do you know these things, my friend?
As a child, maybe you were a little bit of a troublemaker?
It was an education, man. It was an education. That's about it. But yeah, I don't know. Not really. I suppose when you're growing up in suburban Sydney, what other people think is a troublemaker could probably to you and me is kind of small fries. You know?
Oh, I don't know. I grew up in suburban New York. I didn't grow up in suburban Sydney. So, you know, suburban Sydney, I mean, you could have had sex with a kangaroo for all I know. A wallaby.
The problem was is that my parents were worried because I'd been a mute since birth. So, you know what I mean? They wanted to bring out the you know, speech in me. How do you think I'm doing? Is that all right? Am I stuttering?
Yeah, absolutely. But all kidding aside, let's get to the real part of the story, which actually I did find pretty fascinating, which is how you did make this first EP, that you slept on a friend's couch in return for helping with her record, and in return, you got to record your EP, correct? So it was a really interesting little trade, because they had some means and you didn't have means, but you had talent that was needed, correct?
Yeah, absolutely correct. I mean, at that time, I was pretty much a cretin, you know what I mean? And there's some sort of people who can deal with cretins at certain times if they can help them out. And I mean, she's a really good friend of mine, and she'd grown up with her father as an artist, and she'd obviously, her and her mother had obviously seen people like me before, and I'd kind of like, how would you put it, exhausted my welcome at other certain places where I could have, you know, done anything. And, you know, I'm sort of thankful for that time of my life because, I mean, I made that EP for nothing on what you and me now would think looks like, you know, a computer in an 80s movie. But, right. But you know, like, yeah, it kind of sort of changed my life in a way. But at the point of it, you know, it wasn't the highest moment that a 20, 23-year-old, 24-year-old kid can have, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, but, yeah. But that's, you know, there's everybody, you know, there are lots of bands these days, well, we're DIY, but, you know, they can be trust fund babies and be DIY, you know?
Yeah, well, DIY now is $1,000 at the Mac store, you know what I mean? Yeah. DIY back then was a totally different thing, and having to tell... you know, all your friends, you know what I mean, that you actually just made shit for a reason and that, you know, I was doing it since I was a kid when you made tapes and you made certain things and made up record label names and mailed them between each other through states of some guy who had another record who made it. You know, that was the DIY, you know, lining up at record stores when I was 15 and, you know, awkward and trying to get a 7-inch that nobody else had was DIY back then. Now DIY is everybody. You know what I mean? Like, but I mean, I'm not saying that I'm a purist of what it was. I mean, I think it's great that everybody can make records anyway. But at the time, to me, it was astounding. I got a free couch to stay at. They didn't mind me and my lifestyle, and they didn't mind me staying up at all hours of the night on some computer that I'd never used before, making all this crazy music, you know what I mean? And to me, it was like the greatest thing I could ever think of.
You have Triple J, you know, and Triple J is not only, you know, a radio station that's there in Sydney, but it's a radio station that's networked throughout the country.
So it's sort of like a way of life, you know what I mean? Like the Triple J Hottest 100 and things like that. I mean, I'm sort of blessed that they've been so good to me. And these are radio stations that you hear that will play, you know, Kanye West into Joy Division, into like some sort of reggae band, into some roots artist, into something else. You know what I mean? These are not radio stations who have a format and go, this is my format and this is how it is. They're sort of, they're rooted in music loving and it's funded by the government, you know? Yeah. So you got this haven of good things, you know what I mean? And like, I mean, when you're a kid and you think of stuff and you're growing up, like I would not have ever heard Beck. I would not have ever heard Joanna Newsom. I wouldn't have heard the Magnetic Fields like I talked about before. I wouldn't have heard those sorts of things if it wasn't for a station like that, you know what I mean? We might be partial to one thing or partial to another, but I mean, it's the same with the way I make my music. I don't, you know, I remember when I first started, everybody thought, a big sort of sales pitch for everybody was like, it's so genre hopping and words like eclectic, which to me are just like fucking, they're some of the worst words in the English, in the English dictionary, you know what I mean?
So it's like,
there's two types of music, good and bad, you know, and to have, you know, this sort of stringent guidelines on yourself of what you would listen to is weird to me, you know.
One of the things that you obviously do, you know, with a Mr. Tastemaker, or perhaps everybody's in a band. Mm-hmm. You're in a band.
Yeah.
But you are, there are things within you that you want to say, aren't there?
No comment.
Oh, go there. You.
I don't know. All I can say to that is this is answering a question with a question. But one time my manager got me this strange thing where I went to NBC, right? NBC in Los Angeles. He got me in and I did Everybody's in a Band. I performed it on this thing and then he went, okay, sure, okay. So Everybody's in Band, what's that song about? I was like, well, it's quite self-explanatory, but also I suppose it's like, you know, it's one of those songs that sort of haunts me in a way. It's like Rainy Day Woman or something for Bob Dylan, you know what I mean? He said everybody must get stoned, but is that exactly what it meant? I don't know, you know what I mean? And like Everybody's in a Band is that sort of song for me, you know what I mean? I remember when I wrote that song, I wrote I did my first demo of it. I'd already written the song, and I was at this sort of thing that publishing companies do where they send all these writers together and you all write together. Nerve-wracking experiences because everybody writes songs on computers by themselves, you know what I mean? And I went in there and I was standing there with one of, like, a guy that I really like called Chris Knox, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. From Flying Nun Records and that sort of stuff, you know? And him and me did, and I said, and I remember sitting around, not Chris, he was the only one who didn't laugh at me. I remember sitting around with this bunch of people kind of going, I've just written down these titles, you know, and I've got this, you know, and I've written this song as well from this whole thing. I've got this whole new thing going on, and one of them's Everybody's in a Band. You got to hear this, Everybody's in a Band. And they're all like,
But you know, I think Everybody's in a Band could be your version of Randy Newman's I Love L.A.
Well, mate, now you are one of my favorite people that I've ever met ever.
I mean, no, but seriously.
Most charming man.
No. But what I'm getting at is that you see.
Can I get that in writing on a framed picture?
Well, but what I'm saying is that what's good about the song, look, I can tell you how many bands have done, you know, whether it's Electric Six. I can go down the list of parody songs.
Yeah.
Right, but there's parody songs, and you're saying that could be your Achilles heel because people are like, uh-oh, that's what I'm going to become known for.
Yeah.
But isn't it okay to become known for something if that's what gets you in the door?
Well, also, it's a sentiment that I believe in, you know what I mean? Like, I don't really think that it's a ridiculous sentiment. It's not.
I mean, you're in L.A. Now, I don't know how much time you spend in Silver Lake, because I'll tell you what, every time that I go to L.A., and I'm there a lot, my phone lights up with texts and everybody says, what are you doing tonight? And I joke with Silver Lake bands because I've had a bunch of Silver Lake bands on my show, some of which I like.
Yeah.
And I say, you know, if L.A., like, it's tilted. It's amazing that people just don't all slide towards Silver Lake because there's obviously nothing west of Silver Lake.
He's quite wrong, actually, I have to say.
And I'm in San Francisco, well, you know, which is a smaller burb, and you know what? We travel all over the city to see our bands.
This is the thing. There was a thing that was told to me.
I have an Achilles heel about this because I think it's a bunch of nonsense.
I was told, don't go west of Weston, right? With anything you ever do. I was told by somebody.
Oh my gosh, yeah, you might hit some humanity and it might not be perfect coffee.
And I have to say that that's not true, right, to me. But I definitely found a home in places like Silver Lake, Los Feliz, Echo Park, and also, but like Beechwood Canyon and Hollywood. Hollywood, before it goes West Hollywood, I won't touch the Strip. I can't stand the Strip. I'll say that. You can put this on your radio.
You mean you don't want to play and have the smoke and the revolving stage over there at the Viper every night? It's very important.
I played at the Viper Room once, and they chucked me out of the Viper Room, and it was because I was herded in like cattle. I was told that I had all of this stuff that I had to do. I had to keep my equipment outside. I had all my friends standing there doing all
this. The sound guy told you what your mix was going to be.
Like an idiot. And I was maybe a little drunk at that time. But the guy said to me just before we went on, he went, I'd been through this ordeal before I went on stage. And he goes, all right, guys, don't stand on the monitors and don't stand on the drum kit. So first song in, I stood on the monitors and I stood on the drum kit and I got offensive, right? Because I just thought, this is meant to be, you know, I mean, if I told friends I was playing at the Viper Room down in Australia, they'd be like, the Viper Room? Oh my God, the Viper Room.
Right, the coolest thing.
Now, I don't want to defame somebody's business, so, but anyway, the Strip sometimes to me just feels like Disneyland, you know what I mean? Like, I mean, I like Disneyland as much as the next thing, but it's also, I know that it's sort of like a surreal sort of atmosphere. It's not necessarily exactly what is going on in the rest of the world, you know? I've never actually thought of myself as being part of any scene, and scenes to me are cliques of rules, and I didn't really get into rock and roll to be coherent and adherent to rules constantly on what I should be playing and how I should be presenting my music and what right now is it psych rock that I should be doing and these sorts of things. Now, I'm not saying that these sorts of things that you're talking about propagate that sort of behavior, you know what I mean? But I feel like I've always felt a misfit to any sort of musical scene, if that scene exists in the first place, you know what I mean?
Well, it's all perception, reality.
The thing is that I've had a lot of support from places like Spaceland. Like, we've done the Monday residency at Spaceland, and we're seen as sort of like a Silver Lake band, a Silver Lake over to Hollywood sort of band, you know what I mean? So I'm in there in a certain way, but the one thing that I love about Los Angeles is that I go to any night of the week and I see something incredibly different from what I'd seen the night before. And I don't think Hollywood or East LA or those sorts of things put that many rules on music. Now, I've been in hipster scenes all throughout the world at certain points. Like Sydney, if you want to talk about a certain scene, Sydney is a lot more of a scene than LA can be, you know what I mean? And like, but LA has such a vast sort of gamut spectrum of music that is happening there that I love that. I mean, my music doesn't fit because I feel like I got a chance.
We do a thing called a musical sandwich, and it is two of your songs as the bread, and then songs by anybody else you want to play in between.